Hey there, welcome back. Today with me is Max from TalkPush, and we're going to talk about how to hire in the age of AI, in the age of, oh my God, so many applications per an open role and how to fight it. I mean, I'm honestly so excited for this and what you have to say about this. So, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to jump right into this because I was talking to our HR team very recently, and they told me that we in 2025 at Sauce Group, we got something about 43,000 applications for all the roles that we opened in a year.
Nice.
And
Congrats. Congrats to the recruit marketing team.
Yes, but you kind of also feel a little bit bad for them. And I'll be honest, I got a few very angry emails from applicants saying, "Did you even look at my application?" And I'm like, "Yours probably didn't. You're an engineer, have nothing to do with you." But there are people who did. But with TalkPush, I think one of the things that you are optimizing for is how to do the initial screening, how to maybe make it a little bit easier on the HR teams to go through thousands and thousands of applications. But maybe tell me first how to deal with that.
At the risk of sounding a little cliche and startup-y, Anna, there's this popular term of working from first principle. And I don't think that any employer should replicate anyone else's recruitment process. You should ask yourself, what do I really want? Who do I really want? And then how do I collect the information in order to make that best decision? It's not systematically the same thing that you need to do interviews, that you need to do, Google does 9 interviews famously. Some people do 0 interviews. Some of our clients, they just let the AI make the whole decision. And so there's a wide range there. Increasingly, there's a trend for some employers to not read resumes and just rely on the answers of the candidates and the genuine answers. There's also some people who are just heavily leaning on analytics and say, I want to eliminate all human bias, so I'm gonna use automated assessments to make all my decisions and end up with a short list at the end. So, there's no one truth to it. You have to work with what works for your company. And with that, I think you have to put a lot of cynicism when you're evaluating different solutions because, again, there's nothing that there's not a one size fits all. And to illustrate that further, there's without getting too political, there's been a huge movement towards elimination of bias and fairness and more equality of outcome and equality of opportunity. And there's more and more legislation on that. And it sounds great, but in practice, we know that some companies equate a company culture with better retention. And a company culture may have elements of some sort of, elimination process for groups of the population that aren't going to fit in. And so that's a weird conversation to have in many circles, but it's very true that in startups you get a lot of 20 and 30 year olds. And if you're running a Chinese restaurant chain, you're going to have a lot of older Chinese staff. Again, there's not a one size fits all. There's just a great plurality and diversity. We have a, I have a plot, a vision of abundance where if somebody wants work, there is work for them. And so instead of trying to make every employer look and sound the same, I consider my company's mission to more help accentuate the differences of each employer and let them find their true process, their optimized funnel.
That makes great sense. I also, I was listening to you and thought, oh my God, it took you so many words to basically come to a conclusion that, sometimes bias is good, But you just need to, you know, be open and honest about it, and that's your difference. And but you know, we're not allowed to talk about this.
Yeah, it feels like I'm backtracking with my legalese a little bit. Yeah, bias is good. I don't want that to be shared with some of my customers. It's not a good message for my business. But in a way, if you can have a totally unbiased recruitment process that ends up with 10 or 20 shortlisted candidates, and then you do the final selection with all of your biases. And that's like, who do I want to work with me? Because I know every one of those 10 candidates are great. They've been through the ringer. They've gone through the process. And now I'm just going to choose who I want to work with. And again, you know, please, this is not legal advice, but it is, I think, just a pragmatic approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm 100% there with you. And, you know, just to take one more question off the table, because it's also something that I'm very passionate about, and also pretty opinionated. But, you know, some say it's okay to kind of outsource their recruiting, and there are amazing people, amazing teams that work on it, and they're doing a great job. But ultimately, it should be the founder, it should be the person that, you know, drives the company, it should be the person who envisions the company's future that makes the final decision, or, you know, for hiring. Yes. What do you think? Like, can we completely outsource it?
I do the final interviews, and I know companies that get to like 300-400 employees where the founder famously stays involved until the final hiring decision. It's got a, you know, it's kind of like one step into onboarding almost, where it's like, welcome, you know, everybody counts here. And the reason why startups are attractive for employees is because they can count more than in a big company. So I think it's leaning into that natural advantage the startups have. So, you know, practical. I think it's practical. It doesn't cost that much. And And ideally, if the CEO is a little bit experienced and, you know, has like a decade or two of experience under him or her, then he or she can also help to avoid some mistakes that younger managers may make, some hiring mistakes, some blind spots.
Yeah. All right.
I think an older CEO is valuable in that sense.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not going to go into that rabbit hole, but, you know, we kind of started at the end. I'm sorry about that. But let's get to, you know, the origin story and how TalkBush was actually born and how you found that, you know, problem product fit.
It's not my first startup. I had started an applicant tracking software, which is the industry term for recruitment software, prior in Singapore. And before that, I had been a user, and I had done thousands of interviews myself. So, you know, I started from understanding and feeling the problem. And while selling an ATS, a more traditional ATS, I realized that the solutions for high volume recruitment were not designed for emerging markets. When I met some customers, And it seemed to me like a great opportunity to build a company focused on emerging markets, because emerging markets have high volume. Emerging markets don't have budgets, but they have high volume. And so in a way, that was really the observation, is that there's a market, there's a gap in the market. And then after that, it's been 11 years now. So that intuition has been confirmed many times in many countries. You know, we have active customers in 30 plus countries now.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, what now with that international team, like how much of it was intentional because you're working with some of the emerging markets, and how much of it was just, you know, you were pulled by the talent?
Our internal team or our
internal team?
Base?
Yes.
The internal team, when you hire remote, initially I hired in office, and then many years ago we moved to hire close to our customers, which were in the Philippines. And so it was a gradual transition towards a fully remote organization. And, you know, unlike the current trend, which is bringing people back to the office for a lot of startups, we've decided to continue full remote. because it allows us to have better geographical coverage. And this is how we work now. So it would be too disruptive to go to force people back into an office. So
yeah,
it's just a pragmatic approach to keeping everybody happy.
How does it help you with the customers? Ultimately, you've lived in Asia for a while. I've lived in Asia for a while. We both know that. Although, as people, I don't want to call us Westerners. What is the politically correct word for this? But anyway, we came here.
Crackers.
Right. And we call it Asia, right? Asian food, Asian, I don't know, whatever.
Right.
Every country is very, very different. So
it tastes so Asian, right?
Right.
from curry to kimchi, it's all Asian.
Crazy. But yeah, how does it help you now scaling the company and having, people here as well? Does it help with that, cross-cultural communication 101 with your customers?
We see that there is, of course, some markets where you just have to be, from a sales perspective, you need the language. It's the perception is if my account manager, if the person who I'm dealing with doesn't speak my language and doesn't know my country, probably the product is going to have some gaps and probably the support team is not going to be able to follow through. And probably I should just find something local. And that's just the reasonable expectations from customers. So the problem becomes, okay, well, I want to be everywhere, but I can't because I've got limited resources. So then you have to decide the sequence in which you hire. And it's a chicken and egg situation very often where your first hire in a country, is it going to be there before your customers or once you have the customers? And how do you retain them? And I have to say, that's still a work in progress for us. But, I think the mistake that I made a few years ago is I tried to put the chicken before the egg, meaning I tried to hire the staff before the customers, before having the customers. And I think it's a more natural way to, even though you have to be more patient, but it makes more sense to start with having a customer and then hiring around that. And it takes more time, but it has a higher success rate.
Okay. That probably also means that the customers that want you there are also happy to stay with you while you're still kind of figuring it out.
Basically we tell them sign with us and I promise that we'll have someone hired locally in the next 2 months. And you'll get the local support and we can put that in the contract.
Okay. That makes sense. So, again, a little bit about the team, because your full remote distributed team is at about 50 people, right? Mm-hmm. So, with that, how do you keep everyone aligned?
I think we're all creatures of habits. We brush our teeth twice a day, most of us, and we have a coffee. And we have our own cadence. And so that cadence, which has become second nature to everybody, makes it so that I don't lose sleep over whether people are busy or not and whether they're keeping active or not, because I know that every week I receive an email. The whole company receives an email from every 50 member explaining what they've done, any blockers they've had, any discoveries they made. And it's a short email, but it's a simple tool, really. It's just like a weekly update at the end of the week that everybody sends to everybody. And with that, I can use ChatGPT to create a summary for Monday morning, telling people what are the biggest wins and the biggest obstacles to start the week. So they feel they have that volition. And then setting up quarterly targets, meeting every team member once a week, doing appraisals every 6 months, and I'm forgetting a few other cycles. Oh yeah, and we have a 6-week cycle for innovation where we decide what new features to build. Those are mine, and I know other teams have other cadences. That's usually what we try to do, and I think in a lot of startup literature it's explained as you're trying to move away from having good people to having good processes, and I think that's a that's a bit of that. And like another word for process is cadence. It's like, what are the things that we do every day? What are the things we do every week? And then every month and so on. And once you have that in the book, then, you know, you can kind of, you can relax a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, on the weekly basis.
Sorry to interrupt. It's like 4 or 5 highlights of what did we do good last week and 4 or 5 bullet points of obstacles or things that are really bad. And then I added a section recently, which is stuff that I'm reading that I'm interested in with some commentary. And then, at the end, a few big dates or things happening this week. Yeah.
How did you get there? Like, what did you try before that didn't work that eventually landed you on this process?
It used to be, just nothing. And then, I actually heard this simple idea in a podcast one day. I don't even remember who from. And I thought, that's a good idea because you have this, let's say you have a good weekend where you're really relaxed, you're completely unplugged, you drink a little bit of wine. And then Monday morning, you're just kind of, you're trying to pull yourself in and back into work. And I was always thinking as the owner, I'm like, wow, if it's hard for me, imagine how hard it is for the other guys. So what can I do to make it a little bit easier to start their week where they feel like they're plugged in? And it just seemed to me like having an email from the top saying, this is what we're going to do this week was the least I could do. So I sacrificed a little bit of my Sunday for it, but I think it's worth it.
Okay. So, you know, everyone's afraid to say top down these days, but like for you, it works. So a little bit of a leadership to kind of set the day is good.
It's like my job is just to tell everybody who's working at home what's happening across the rest of the organization. I wouldn't call it top down. It's just more, I'm like an info board.
Okay. All right. That's a good one. We'll call it that. But I also remember when we talked previously with you, you said that, yes, I mean, everything works and remote is great. And I agree with that. But you also have very frequent trips where either you visit local offices or people just come together to meet each other. How does that work? And again, why did you decide that this is something important for your particular culture?
They're not that frequent. We get together twice a year, the management team. And I used to have the aspiration more democratically to bring everybody together. But we have people in Chile and people on the, in Taiwan. So to bring everybody together would literally, cost us, 100,000 or more per event, and it's just too expensive. So we have to do it with management, and then get some regional get-togethers, and just hope that helps to reduce some of the friction and tension that happens naturally when you're trying to solve hard problems together. The fact that people have been able to break bread and have a meal together will ease some of this collaboration later on. And so it's mild, I'd say, in terms of travel budget, because they're very expensive, these trips.
They are
when you're all over the world. And the customer ends up having to pay for it, and our customers deserve better than paying our international trips all day.
We're bringing together 400 people this year, so yeah. It the budgets are through the roof, but yeah, it's also so much fun to see everybody and to, we are also growing so much, and it's not like adding one person to the team, it's adding a team to the team. So, sometimes you end up not really knowing who works with you this year, and, those trips just are so beneficial.
Yeah. When you hire with a primary focus to hire remotely, you sometimes attract a group of people who are so comfortable with remote work that you really have to kick their butts to get on a plane and to go meet their colleagues. And I think that once somebody is past probation, that's necessary for them to meet people in the flesh. And so that Yeah, and that's not that doesn't happen naturally. You kind of have to force it. So I would recommend that. And we're in the process of doing that with a couple of people we hired in unusual locations. And those who resist, that's not a good sign.
Okay. I mean, if it's a core of your culture, then yeah, probably not. But how to eliminate that, you know, because I think a lot about, you know, this problem. When they told me about 43,000 application, I was like, how do you do that? Like, it's crazy. How do you sift through that? There should be some automation. But at the same time, I know, I remember how I was hired. I was basically just, somebody saw me on LinkedIn doing a podcast, liked it, thought, you know, the vibe check went great, and hired me. This is a totally different game. And how do you sift through all those applications to find not just good hard skills, but also a person that, yeah, that passes that vibe check, that will be a great addition to the team?
I'm biased because I'm a vendor, so I can tell you our vision for the future. But, you know, I guess for your listeners, understand that I'm actually building it. So our vision for the future and what we're using currently already is everybody who applies gets to have a chat with a voice AI. And it sounds human-like, and it's like, hello, tell me why you want to work here, and blah, 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 and scores the candidate at the end of the conversation and makes them feel like they've been heard. And, you know, there's something a bit creepy for some people to be talking to an AI where they're still uncomfortable with that interface. So it's not necessarily for every group. But obviously for somebody who's applying for our company, it makes total sense. And for a lot of our customers, it makes sense too, because Gen Z, especially for younger people, like they would rather just be heard and get processed and get an immediate answer rather than have to wait for a human to be available. And there's been studies made that would you rather be interviewed by an AI now or by a human later? And 80% of people say AI now. Just get it done. And so that is generally the preferred method for candidates. And for the employer, it's extremely, you know, it's much easier because you can eliminate people based on their fluency, their ease of communication, you know, simple parameters like that, like grammar and fluency. And then you can also look for particular keywords. And instead of, you know, and the AI will never make a mistake. It will not ask leaning questions. It won't have a bias for a certain group, and it's patient, which I'm not, and a lot of people are not with interviews. Is, you know, even if you give them a very good interview script to a human, they will ask the questions. If you know, at the least they'll do is ask the question on the script. But they may not listen to the answer. And so if a candidate answers completely sidetracked, which happens a lot, where, and I'm sure as an interviewer, you've noticed that people don't answer the question. So you have to get back to the question. But with the AI never forgets to get back to the question. Just, it's as patient as needs to be. So that there's a lot of great, you know, great benefits to asking an AI to do the interviews for you. And I think it'll be the norm in the next couple of years. But still a little bit edgy now.
Yeah. While you were talking and you said, you know, AI doesn't make mistakes and, you know, AI just kind of follows the script. Sometimes, you know, maybe it could be a problem. Correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe you were doing something very different, but just a very, very simple example. I think it was either Perplexity or ChatGPT. One of those. But yeah, I was saying something about myself. So it was just a simple test. And I wanted a response. And then I wanted to figure out if, you know, another person will start talking for me. Yeah, we'll get it. And it didn't. And I was like, okay, so all those, again, like online interviews with AI, how easy is it to trick it?
Yeah, great. Well, yeah, there's a lot of work on that done by vendors, including us. And sometimes the word that's used to describe this area is proctoring. So a lot of old vendors, you know, the legacy vendors, they would they would take a snapshot, a picture with a camera to make sure that it's the same person who stays on the whole time. So that's quite common. You can also cheat that because you can put your face and have somebody else speak. But I think and then of course there's a lot of answers that are, if you do an asynchronous application where you fill a form, question, answer, and you don't force people to answer straight away in a live interface, then they're going to obviously research the best answer. They're going to type in their answer on ChatGPT and they're going to say, okay, make it better. Then they're just going to read it. And that's why everybody is not only drowned with, like you said, 440,000 applications, but it's even worse than that. It's 40,000 excellent applications. So you're really in trouble because everybody's got an excellent resume, excellent cover letter, excellent everything. And everybody's faced with this problem right now, employers, universities. If you do a live call where the questions are not scripted, where it's audio, so you cannot copy paste the questions in ChatGPT, the rate of cheating and the honesty of the answers goes up tremendously. The rate of cheating goes down, the honesty of the answers goes up. And we calculated the incidence of people reading the text before and after moving to live. And we had like a 40% drop of people reading. So they're more likely to just answer naturally because it's a conversation like you and I are having where I don't have the scripted question. So I just have to answer off the cuff. And so I think that improves things significantly. And then with the voice, you can, what the example you were giving is you ask somebody to jump in and answer for you. That does happen, but you can create a voice print ID and it's very cheap to track if it's the same person at the beginning, at the end, in the middle of the interview. So what we recommend is you do a video question. And, ask the candidate to do a video submission. Then you compare the voice ID to the voice that they do during the rest of the interview. And if they match, you're good. But, find someone who's going to, slip through the cracks.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
That's true. I mean, at the end of the day, they get to a human interview and it's probably crap. But it's also interesting that you said it's not just 43,000 applications, 43,000 excellent applications. No, it's not.
Okay.
That's, yeah,
some people didn't do their homework.
That's also what was so frustrating to me because it was like, okay, but there is AI. Like if you really, really want it and you think you can maybe wing it, then at least put some effort with ChatGPT, with whatever AI that is available there and give me some excellent work. We also asked how you leverage AI, put it there. Everything you read now, AI generated. I don't know crap about M&A, but there are so many just random applications. It hurts.
Okay. Well, I still suspect that the quality of your application pool is better today than it was 2 years ago before people were on ChatGPT. And the pass rates are increasing on standardized assessments because of that. So it's creating a new world of problems. So I describe it often as an arms race. The candidates have their weapons, their artillery, mm-hmm. their AI. The employers have their, and they basically are going to have to keep buying more weapons so that they can duke it out.
That's true. I once had a podcast and we were talking about AI, and the founder that was talking to me, he was like, you know what, there is this exceptional tool now where, you know, like you said, when it's an asynchronous interview, then they can go and read something and then read it back as their answer. He said he was, while we were having an interview, he was running this tool that in real life, in real time, was offering him answers. And I was like, oh my God, did you do the podcast with me with that thing? I was so terrified. It was like, no, I didn't use the answers, but they were pretty good. So yes, I mean, you're
increasingly, we're all going to work that way anyway, right? A lot of our customers are contact center operators, and this is how a contact center works these days. There's a live conversation and there's a little thing on your screen that tells you what to say, what script to say, how to handle an inquiry. And I suspect that's going to be the norm for, you know, all interaction. It'll all be augmented and aided. So, yeah, it's weird when you find employers who want to eliminate people for using AI, but it happens a lot.
Yeah. I bet. All right. Well, I also want to ask, you know, about your journey as a founder, right? The fact that you guys are bootstrapped. And when we had our conversation prior to the podcast, you said that at a certain point you were thinking about selling a company maybe, but then you shifted to growing sustainably and, you know, building something that really lasts. And I want to ask you about that shift, you know, why it was like that and what made you go from the idea of selling a company to, you know, I'm just going to build it.
There's, 11 years is a long time, and you can, I think you change all the cells in your body every 7 years or something. I don't know if I'm the same person today that I was when I started. I think I'm more patient, and I've had the time in 11 years. I think it doesn't matter what area of technology you're in. If you look at your competitive set now and then 3 years later, it's usually completely different. And I've, you know, in 11 years, I've seen like at least 3 or 4 generations of looking at my competitive set and being like, it's completely different. And usually what happens is companies crash or they get acquired into a giant behemoth vendor. And then, you know, their value proposition usually dilutes and their rate of innovation dilutes and their prices go up. So there's an opportunity, right? And there are very few just stick around. So that's a little known advantage, is that if you're willing to do this for not a decade, but 2 or 3, that will compound, I believe. And so I'm experiencing it. And there's great joy in that. There are some companies, there's many companies that are actually in that space, but they don't get as much coverage as the ones that are hyperscalers. So my journey as an entrepreneur has been defined by the shift in the kind of media that I consume, starting with TechCrunch and gradually moving towards, like, you know, lifelong entrepreneurs is now what I study, what I research, and what I'm interested in. And yeah, I don't say it's for everybody, but I'd say it's been a rewarding journey to transition from one group to the other. I still love San Francisco and TechCrunch and you know, and all the crazy innovation that happens with the crash and burn startup ecosystem. but in my own self-interest and the interest of my customers, it's better for me to build something a little bit more long-lasting and with a broader set of solutions, and rather than just a point solution.
Yeah, I believe, you know, TechCrunch is the SaaS version of MTV. But, I mean, everyone's just so excited about this. But, you know, I'm just curious, like, what kind of, you know, mindset, I don't know, shift or alignment you had to go through with the, like, a new idea, with that new idea that, you know, you said to yourself, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to look at TechCrunch and be excited for all those guys. But, you know, I don't want that.
I, I think I'm in the world of action more than the world of ideas, and having taken bad advice from investors, advisors, and media for many years, I have been able to filter through what advice I should not be taking again. And so that's really been the process. It's like when you've tried all the ideas from San Francisco that don't work for you, then you have to try something else. So it's been more of a experimental journey.
Okay.
So yeah, that's it. And it's also like when you get older, you can be a little bit more patient and say, okay, well, let's put things on hold for 6 months on the growth and fix the tech debt, or a year even. You know, you can look at a year and say we're going to slow down on sales for a year. You can do that, but you can't really do that when you're just starting because it's too scary, especially when. I think when you're a business founder as opposed to a tech founder, you want to be able to contribute, and you want to be able to directly do the work. And since you can't code, since you can't fix the product, all you can do is sell more. And so if you're a business founder, you have a natural inclination towards hiring more sales, hiring more marketing, because that's what you understand and that's what you can control more. But that's very treacherous. Right. If your product is not ready and your customers are not ready, then you're going to burn through a lot of cash. So I think it's a word of caution, I guess, for sales inclined founders to not hire too fast on sales and marketing.
Yeah. I mean, here on the podcast, I've heard very polar opinions, right? So there are technical founders that say, you know what, we didn't do any marketing ever. We just shipped an amazing product and it kind of sold itself. There were people that are more on the sales side that said, never, never write a line of code before you have 10 sales. And, sure. You know, yeah, it's funny that everyone is very, you know, it's very solid on what worked for them. And then you end up not really knowing what's good.
Yeah, this is how it works.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, the mistake that I've made, and I'm sure many companies have made, is that I hired too fast in sales, and I tried to apply a scalable model to a business that wasn't ready to scale. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I think many people have made that mistake, but
that's true.
And it's easier to make that mistake when you're playing with other people's money.
Yes. Yeah. Again, so many VC funded founders have been here, but you know, at the same time, a lot of bootstrappers that I've talked to said, you know what, it's easier, but it also gives you so much freedom. And then, you know, when you find your product market fit eventually, you still, you know, you didn't have to struggle through it. Like, it's just, let's face it, sometimes you just don't want to struggle through it. So, yeah.
If the window of opportunity is closing down, then, yeah, anything to gain 6 months or 12 months might be the difference between being number one and being number 10. So I think it's absolutely necessary for some markets. I've taken the, you know, is it the turtle and the hay and the hare? The story. I'm doing the turtle approach where I'm finding the markets that need time to grow.
So what's the non-negotiable for TalkBush? Like you have a certain freedom now, right, with the path you've chosen. But what is something that you're absolutely 100% on it all the time?
In terms of my personal activity?
In terms of you in the business and business in you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do have a lot of freedom. So then I just have to send my email on Sunday night. And like I told you, and my updates every month. And it's just the cadence, really. It's just a habit. Just like some people wake up and do some push-ups. So whether I can unplug from that one day, well, I don't know. I don't know if once you're in the matrix, it's maybe hard to get out. No, other than that, everything's a white piece of paper and you can reinvent yourselves. Some companies have a lower tolerance for aggressive and asshole behaviors for some staff. And they say, that's where I draw the line, is you can't mistreat people. Of course, I feel the same way. We all feel the same way, but passion can take many forms. You can have somebody who is very passionate about what they're doing and they come across as being rude or insensitive. So you have to find the balance that works in your environment. In an enterprise SaaS business, there's a sense of urgency mixed with also a reactivity, because your customers demand immediate response to immediate problems. And that creates a nervousness around the organization. And so you need to work with people who have, who are geared that way, who aren't like chilled San Diego surfers and who are a little bit more, tense. And so perhaps, I wouldn't tolerate somebody being abusive or mistreating anybody in the company, but we do, I do welcome conflict in some form. So and I don't know. It's one way to answer your question, Anna.
That's amazing. I think with that answer, we kind of did a full circle to that first question that I asked, how to make sure that even with all the AI and automation, you still get people that you want and you get that cultural alignment. And, that's how you differentiate yourself and how you, are being honest. And I think it's a lot better to just say that rather than be like, yeah, we just, we are a family. Like what, we welcome all the nice people, no, some people are not.
We would rather the nice people go work for our customers.
Great. That's a great answer. All right. Well, I have just a couple more questions for you, right? The usuals here. So 11 years, you've chosen your path, but what has been the biggest win and the biggest failure for you personally as a founder or for the business?
Well, biggest win, biggest failure. you always go back to people. So we could talk about, some great hires and some great mishires. And then we could talk about markets and the markets we failed at. And I'd say on the people front, definitely some of the best hires came from unexpected places, where I think my two best ever, maybe even three best ever commercial hires, I hired them in countries where I didn't even have headcounts. So it was like an open job posting and somebody applied from, an odd place. Or one guy, we got him from an ad on Instagram. So if you grow your funnel and you kind of send out a message to the world, you can be pleasantly surprised. So that's something that's been experienced and lived, and there's great people everywhere, basically. And we have someone in Chile, someone in Pakistan, someone in Venezuela, someone in Uruguay, and just completely random. And they're the best that we could find for those jobs. So to lean into that advantage has been a wonderful experience. And that was one of the great wins. And I think the biggest failure, going back to what I said earlier, is this idea that you can force your way into a market by hiring people and selling there. It's not enough. Like you really need to build a good product that the geography wants. And if they want it, and you have paying customers and you have revenue, then hire. So the mistake to hire too soon and say, Talkbush is opening in India, Talkbush is opening in, Brazil or South Africa. We tried these things. It doesn't work. It's not enough to just make an announcement and hire somebody. You really need to first find your happy customers.
All right. Yeah. I mean, That's a great one. I think that's a learning that a lot of people will appreciate. But if there is anything else, really actionable hack that another founder can do right here, right now, after listening to this, maybe you can share that too.
Well, I think I gave my best hack with a weekly update. you know, I don't log into Slack. So
ever.
That's productivity hack.
Yeah, all right.
For founders that are non-technical founders that are having a hard time setting a cadence for their engineering work and getting getting a hard commitment from engineering, like we will deliver something next week or next month on a particular feature or project. If that resonates with somebody in the audience, I'd recommend that they check out the Basecamp methodology called Shape Up, which is already a few years old, but it's not the most popular with everybody in the team, but for me, it helps a lot have a sense of control over when are we going to get the things that we said we were going to get. So that's been helpful.
Somehow Slack is getting lots of bad rep these days. So yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for the story and for walking me through, everything that happened and everything that worked and didn't work for you. It's been great having you here, Six. And,
It's been fun to share. And I hadn't been on camera for a while, and I wanted to see if I could still, get to an interview. And I hope we'll get a chance to be interviewed by you in another 10 years.
Absolutely. Maybe sooner. Hopefully soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Max. And take care. Thanks for listening. SaaS Unbound is brought to you by SaaS Group. We're a long-term home for great B2B SaaS. We buy, keep the team and brand DNA, and help with the boring stuff like hiring and finance so founders can truly focus on building great products. If you're a founder who'd like to be featured